This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Plagued with murders, gangs, crack, prostitution, and AIDS, West Baltimore was the archetype of black inner-city America in the 1980s, a dangerous place for a black kid to find his way to manhood. Writer Ta-Nehisi Coates escaped the fate of too many others from the old neighborhood. In a memoir called The Beautiful Struggle, Coates writes about his father, Paul Coates, Vietnam veteran and one-time leader of the local chapter of the Black Panthers, one of the relatively few fathers who stayed in that neighborhood to help raise his seven children. He tells the story of how he and his older brother, Big Bill, dealt very differently with the challenges and temptations of the street. And he explains two very different kinds of knowledge, the language of the street corner and the political consciousness he learned from his father and from his father's books. Later in the hour, we're going to hear the stories of those of you caught up in the terrible weather in the Midwest. If you can get to a computer, send us an email now. That's talk@npr.org, and we'll get to your calls later. But first, Ta-Nehisi Coates and The Beautiful Struggle. If you shared that experience in the inner city and faced your own struggle, call and tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Ta-Nehisi Coates contributes to the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, O, and other publications. His book is called The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you so much for having me, Neil.
And I have to say, I read this book with some dread. We, of course, know what happened to you in the end, but I thought something terrible was going to happen to your brother.
Yeah. Well, I guess now we know it didn't.
No, it didn't.
It did not. No, he's fine and well. He works with my father in Baltimore. Ended up okay. And if you felt some dread reading the book, you can imagine how my father and my mother felt and his mother felt throughout his childhood and my childhood.
Because it was a touch-and-go thing.
It was indeed a very touch-and-go thing. I do have to make one thing clear because this sort of often gets meshed together. I was not in any respect impoverished. I had two parents. I always, you know, had food on the table, always had clothes on my back. But I think one of the sort of, I don't know, blessings, tragedies of being African American in this country is you're only two steps away of those who are going through a very different economic struggle than yours. We are tied together, and you know that is both beautiful and at the same time problematic. And so I think what the book documents is how my parents tried to steer me through that, you know, sort of maze of decisions and choices that come from those connections. But at the same time, I think also sort of the more beautiful aspects, I keep using beautiful, I got to think of another word, but some of the more beautiful aspects of living. I had a great time in West Baltimore. Despite all the things that you presented in the introduction that are definitely true, I loved living there. I wouldn't change a thing about it.
In fact, when your father eventually decided to move out,
I was heated.
And you challenged him. How can you be leaving the people?
I did. And you know what? He gave me probably the best answer you could. You know, my dad at the time was, I believe, about 42 years old. And he said, son, I've never had a big backyard in my life. And I think I was about 14 or 15 years old. And there was absolutely nothing I could say to that.
Your book is in many ways, it's a love letter to your dad.
It is. It is indeed a love letter to my dad. Not an uncomplicated love letter to my dad, because we had, you know, a very, very complicated relationship. But the book actually started, it was supposed to be a memoir of him and his times, because, you know, just as a writer, I found his story just so provocative. I mean, here's a man who comes from, I mean, complete poverty in North Philly, raised in West Philly sometime, goes off to the Vietnam War, joins the Black Panther Party, sires seven kids by four women, all of whom go to college, everyone who graduated from college except me. I'm actually the only one who did not graduate from college.
You slacker.
I know, completely. And I thought, you know, against, you know, the backdrop of, we know what the 1980s and the early 90s were for Black America. I know that, you know, it's great talk of the difficulties that African Americans face today. But for my money, that was just such a troubling time with crack, with HIV seemingly coming out of nowhere, the rise of teen pregnancy, so many things, the expansion of the prison population, so many things going wrong. And against that backdrop, I just just think my father, and I have to say my mother and the mothers of the other children, just did such a tremendous job, a tremendous job. Like I said, I'm the only one who didn't graduate from college. So if anything, you know, I sit at the bottom of the totem pole.
You describe your father at one point as saying, my dad turned conservative, not in the way of the demonologist who sold out for crumbs and tenure, more like a man who spurns the false talk of revolution for the humbler goal of resurrecting one soul at a time.
Yeah, you got to do it. You got to do it. And my dad, it's actually very tough for me to imagine my father in the Black Panther Party. I was born in 1975, and by that point, he had been gone for about 3 years. I certainly knew people in my time as a child who spent their time, you know, talking black, you know, we got to do this, we got to do that. And my impression, my father didn't talk. He really, really, really did. Not in that respect. You know, he was all about, go do it. You know, don't talk me to death, son. You know, go do it. If you're going to be about it, you're going to be about it. And I think one of the things about, you know, he took from his experience in the Panther Party, it's nice to, you know, talk revolution and, you know, do all this and bluster and you got your guns, you got your beret. You know, and as I say that, I have to say that that experience was very important to him. But at the end of the day, there comes a time when, you know, people have to work to make whatever values they hold manifest in the society. And that was what my dad was always about.
And the way he did it was to start a press, a publishing company.
He did.
In your basement.
He did. And he told me this story. You know, I'm of a completely different era, but and I retell this story in the book. I was interviewing him and I was talking to him about the inspiration for the press that he has now, which the basic business model is to go back and republish the works of African-American authors who worked before a time when people got advances like I got an advance for this book for just, you know, they couldn't stop themselves from writing. And a lot of this work was out of print. And my dad ended up going into the business of basically reprinting these sorts of works. And I talked to him about his inspiration. And one of the things he said, again, and being of a different generation, it's completely shocking to me, but Kim Il-sung, I think I have this right, that's the father, I believe, of Kim Jong-il. I got
it
that
is.
Right. Okay, so he tells this story about the North Koreans, you know, fighting against colonialism, and I want to say they were fighting against the Japanese. I may be mangling that story.
You got that right, too.
Okay, all right, so they're fighting against the Japanese, and Kim Il-sung inspires his troops by saying, look, you know, when it comes time to fight, you know, everybody grabs for their guns, but the hero of the nation will reach for the mimeograph machine, because the mimeograph machine rules all. You know, it's just a more romantic depiction of the pen being mightier than the sword. And that was told to my dad in the Panther Party, as crazy as that story sounds. And it left a tremendous impression on him. And he believed that and he carried that through his life. And, you know, I really, you know, say that he imprinted that on me, because that's certainly what I believe and what I was taught.
We're talking with Ta-Nehisi Coates about growing up in West Baltimore in the 1980s. If you shared a similar experience somewhere between on the spectrum between the streets and the suburbs and somewhere through there made your way to manhood, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And Clark is on the line with us. Clark calling us from Niles in Michigan.
Hello. I just have a statement. It's kind of a different situation. My parents didn't encourage me not to do this and not to do that. My mother was a drug dealer, and my father was an alcoholic, constantly beating my mother up all the time. And my mother eventually divorced my father, but my mother throughout my childhood talked down on my father, so I never wanted to spend time with him, and she did not encourage me not to do drugs. I ended up doing drugs at the age of 12, and I learned from their mistakes to better myself, and my children helped me out a lot too.
Your kids, you're a parent now yourself.
Yes, I have two children.
And are you tough on them?
Yes, I'm really scared of what's going to happen or what their influence, you know, their surroundings, my girlfriend's friends, what my girlfriend does as well. I quit drinking. I lost a lot of friends. Of course, they weren't really friends in the first place, you know.
Yeah. It sounds like it's interesting. I wonder if you would agree with this. Ta-Nehisi Coates writes in his book that his father regarded the lives of people around 12 to 18. This was the age when the abyss, where unguided black boys were swallowed whole, only to find themselves later on street corners in prison tiers. It sounds like you went through that experience yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call.
Very rough experience, too. You're welcome.
Thanks very much for the call. Your father, though, you know, radical politics, he described himself as a practicing fascist.
He was a he's a dictator, as any good father must be, as any great father must be. He was indeed a dictator and an idiosyncratic dictator. I think one of the things that I keep getting asked as I do these interviews is you know, people keep saying that my father was strict. And strict wasn't so much the problem for me as a child. He was just weird. I mean, who does not eat on Thanksgiving? Who protests Christmas? I mean, weird, weird. And in my neighborhood, it was like, who owns a business republishing books? I think the hardest thing for me to grapple with as a child was how different my dad was. I have to say, though, as I was listening to the gentleman who just called in, I thought of my father because I always just stare in wonder at people who... I know why I'm okay to the extent that I'm okay. I had tremendous amounts of support. As I've said before, I was basically dragged across the finish line by my parents and by my wider community. It's completely corny to say, but I desperately believe that it in fact does take a village to raise a child. No matter how cliche that sounds, I mean, that doesn't have anything to do with whether it's true or not. I say all that to say, I simply marvel at people who sort of just emerge from the earth and who, of their own volition and their own decisions, sort of make their way out. And I it was, again, one of the reasons why I started trying to do this story on my father, because I just had no understanding for how he could be so different, as far as I was concerned, from where he came from.
Yeah, he told you your whole life, at 18 years old, son, you're out of this house.
You're out of here.
And it turned out he was lying.
He was lying. Now, I did leave at 18, but he was my father. He turned out to be much kinder than I expected. I think once the fear dissipated, I guess it freed him up for a sort of compassion. Also, once, you know, children change, and when you're young, I think, you know, at varying times, fear is a very effective tool. And once, to his mind, fear stopped being an effective tool, our relationship changed greatly. He'd always say, you know, I'm not here to be your friend. I'm here to keep you on the right path. And once that relationship changed, I think my whole way of relating to my dad also changed.
We're talking with writer Ta-Nehisi Coates this hour about growing up in the inner city of Baltimore in the 80s, and we'd like to take your calls. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Ta-Nehisi Coates grew up in the drug-ravaged landscape of late 80s Baltimore, where every day can be a struggle. But luckily, his father, a former Black Panther and radical book publisher, gave him the tough love he needed to succeed. He's written a book about his childhood. You can find an excerpt on our website at npr.org. It's called The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and the Unlikely Road to Manhood. We're talking with him about it today. We'd also like to hear from you. If you faced your own struggle growing up in the inner city or the suburbs, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And let's get Ralph on the line. Ralph's with us from San Antonio in Texas.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
I am retired at this point, but in the 70s, late 70s and 80s, I was a Baltimore detective with the Baltimore Police Department, and I knew your guests. Father. I had occasion to interview Mr. Coates on a couple of occasions, and I must say that at a time when things were a great deal different than they are today, and the Black Panthers being a very, very militant organization, when I interviewed Mr. Coates, you could tell that there was something different about him. The look in his eyes, even though I did not, at that time, understand or cared a great deal for his point of view, you knew that there was something there that he was a very strong individual, and I had a great deal of respect for him.
I'm sorry, what's your name again?
Ralph.
Okay. I really hope he's listening. This is fascinating for me. Wow.
I know that we would occasionally see each other on the street from time to time after I had the opportunity to interview him. And I must say that it was regarding some crimes that had taken place. We were interviewing a great number of the black militants in the city. And there was, even then, obviously, we were all much younger.
Right.
You could tell that there was something special about Mr. Coates, and I'm very glad that to hear how well his family has done, and you should be very proud of your father.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That I'm not going to say anything else. I'm speechless. I don't know what to say. Thank you.
Ralph, thank you. Thanks very much for the call.
It's been my pleasure.
All right. Appreciate it. That's interesting.
That is stunning.
Yeah.
I hope he's listening. I really do.
Well, he can get the iPod, the download, the podcast. But in any case, you describe in the course of this book a couple of, you know, flowerings of radicalism that sort of then collapse in various ways. One, of course, the ignition of the Panthers themselves, in which your father got caught up, and
yes,
various factions disrupted. Then later, in the hip hop era, where some of the rappers, and Chuck D in particular, you emulated, again, another blossoming of thought that collapsed again. Is this cyclical, do you think?
Yeah. God, Pat Buchanan had a great quote on this, because, you know, everybody's going, that's the collapse of the conservative movement, right? But it's something like, you know, everything starts out as an insurrection, becomes a movement, and then becomes a racket. So there's a quote like that. I wish I had it at hand. But that is essentially what happens.
So far, you've quoted Kim Il-sung and Pat Buchanan.
Maybe we'll get some Baldwin in here in a moment. But I have to say that the one thing I regret, because as much as this book is a love song to my dad, it's a love note also to hip hop, which, as I will always say, taught me how to think, taught me how to write. It just taught me to love language. And I wish someone had told me when I was 14 or 15 that, son, one day this is going to become a racket too. You know, because I was young and naive and thought, wow, it's going to be like this forever. And of course, it was not. So everything falls, everything changes, yeah, everything declines.
I'm sure glad rock and roll escaped that fate. Anyway, I wanted to ask you, through your dad, you knew Tupac Shakur's mother, and tangentially Tupac Shakur himself. You said he exchanged some rhymes with your brother at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And then you don't write about him again, not part of the flowering or part of the collapse.
Right. Well, there are a couple of reasons for that. The first reason is that they left Baltimore. And so, it, like, in the story, I did not. I was deeply tempted to not put that in the story at all. And my editor actually made me put it in. And the reason was not out of any sort of disrespect for him or his family, quite the opposite. I didn't want to feel like I was name dropping. I mean, Tupac now, his legacy, his mythology, it just overwhelms everything. And so I didn't want it to feel like I was writing this book and I was saying, you know, raising my hand, I knew Tupac too. I didn't want it to be a distraction from the core narrative. But the place where it came in was important. I mean, it worked with the story. I struggled with that.
But
I very much did.
You and your friends, though, must have followed his subsequent career with some interest.
Yes, yes, yes. I remember seeing him on TV when he made it big, and it was quite shocking. I did, and I must say with great sadness for, when it went down that path and when it looked like he was headed that way and for the ultimate result, it was completely heartbreaking to me, both him and Biggie. Just, deeply depressing and deeply heartbreaking.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line, and let's go to Nicole. Nicole's with us from Sacramento.
Yes, hi. Thank you for having this gentleman on the interview. I grew up in Oakland, California, early 70s up until the late 80s, Bancroft East 14th area, and there was a lot of drugs. Had some cousins who started using drugs when they were 10 years old, 12 years old, 13 years old, and most of them are homeless, still on drugs, in and out of jail. So it's not, you know, grew up all boys. I'm a public health nurse. I work with a lot of the kids that I, type of kids that I grew up with, and being able to relate based upon the history. So, you know, growing up that way and then being able to contribute positively is wonderful, and it gives us a lot of insight, I think. So I take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Well, I was just going to ask Nicole, do you think it's tougher now or when you grew up in the 80s?
Well, it's a whole different ball game now, I think. In the 80s, like the gentleman said, when crack came out, HIV was coming out. I think that the education wasn't as prevalent as it is now in regards to drugs. And, you know, another thing that happened with my cousins, they were all boys, but they all got molested. So, you know, there was a lot of information that wasn't given to us as kids, whereas the kids nowadays, I think a lot of information is available to them. There's books. There's self-help books, counselors, and just a lot of more awareness. So I'm not sure if it's harder, but I will say that the awareness is more prevalent now.
Hmm. Thank you, Nicole. Appreciate the phone call.
Can I just I just want to say, I think she really hit on something that I hadn't even thought of, and that being the education piece. I, you know, even as a child, I think the violence, the gun violence in the cities was just completely shocking to so many people. There was no precedent for that many guns being available on the street for children, essentially children so young, to having guns available to them, to being able to kill people over the smallest things, over hats, jackets. And I think people just went into a sort of shock. I mean, again, even as a child, you know, who had no previous experience, I knew that something was deeply wrong. Something was deeply, deeply wrong. And even for people who, you know, did not have relatives who didn't get killed, the very presence of it, the idea of maybe you might get shot, it just haunted everything. And it really corrupted everything.
And your brother, at one point, got himself a gun.
He did indeed.
And you write it increased his confidence because he knew that whatever happened, he could reach into his bag and pull out the ultimate word.
That's right. And I, you know, the book opens on an act of violence. And once you lose control of your body in that sort of way, or have your body taken control of in that sort of way, you never want that to happen again. And you'll do anything to prevent that. And I think that was really the space from which he was approaching it. And I think for so many young black boys and probably young boys in general in a similar economic situation, so much of it is a part of that. You just want to be in control. And the idea that the most normal things that all kids do, going to see your first crush, walking down the street, going to a basketball court, the idea that you might encounter some sort of violence, just as I say, it just corrupts everything.
Well, let's get Totney on the line. Totney with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Totney Brandt. Once again, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love your show.
Thank you.
A few comments of the writer resonated with me. I'm Caribbean American. I did not grow up, I wouldn't say I grew up impoverished. I didn't grow up in a black slum or a deeply black rooted neighborhood, but my family wasn't well off. My dad was a self-employed carpenter. I mean, we were on... we went to go to the food bank every once in a while to get food. But what resonated with me was the parents that pushed, and my parents were very pushing parents. They were the type that weren't satisfied with an A-minus because they said you could get an A. And as a result of their pushing, you know, my brother and my sister and myself have become very successful, and it's really, you know, all thanks to them. My brother is working on his MD, PhD, and I just graduated with my medical doctorate here at the University of Michigan, and it's really all because I had parents that pushed, that were able to push me.
And did you thank them at the time when you were growing up?
Pardon me?
At the time when you were growing up, when they were telling you your A-minus wasn't good enough, were you thanking them?
I mean, no, probably not. I was the lazier of the three kids, to be honest, and I was more into having fun than I was into focusing on my grades and so on. So I needed the pushing, and I kind of knew it, but I didn't really, you know, it didn't really surface as such in my consciousness, I don't think.
Yeah. Thanks very much. I think that story, though, of parents whose efforts we don't understand when we're young, well, that's all over your book.
Yeah, and there's the saddest thing. You can't replace that. I don't think that there's anything you can do to replace two parents who are applying pressure. As I said earlier, I very much believe in the ethos of the village and children, but the core of that is the parents and two loving parents who just really, really push and put their boot on the neck of their children and say, you will. I mean, I shudder to think, I say this all the time, in my time in school, in my time in the neighborhood, I met so many black boys who were smarter, who in fact did better in school than I did. But at the end of the day, I had somebody to grab me by my collar and said, you will, whether you want to or not, you will. And I'm talking all the way up into through college. I don't know what I would have been without that. I don't know what would have happened.
I wanted to ask you, though, you said it takes a village, where there was a group called the Akobia Elders.
Akobia, yes.
Akobia, excuse me for the
right
mispronunciation.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was a rites of passage group right here in Washington, D.C. that my dad put me through. And again, that was just part of the complete, you know, the feeling was there was a lack of ritual. There was a lack of something to offer us transition from boyhood into men that you know, boys were going around acting like men, but had no sense of manhood in any complete sort of way. That to be a man to them was just to, you know, puff out your chest and be violent when you thought it was appropriate. And that was an organization that, I mean, just completely, completely shaped me and just gave so much in terms of my ability to define myself as a complete person.
Ta-Nehisi Coates' book is The Beautiful Struggle. He's with us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Tanya on the line. Tanya's calling us from Midwest City in Oklahoma.
Hi. Thank you for taking my telephone call.
Sure.
I wanted to just comment and say that I completely identify with and understand what Mr. Coates is talking about. I had two parents that really pushed me, and just a family and a network of friends and teachers that they knew I was a good kid. And even though we were in the ghetto, I'm from New Haven, which is the home of Yale, but also has a very crime rate. It has a very high crime rate. So you've got these, you know, beautiful houses that are nestled against the absolute ghetto. But I had a family that pushed me to do the best that I could do. I had teachers that when they realized that I love learning, that I love school, they gave me opportunities, you know, to really prove myself and push myself. And now I'm getting my master's and my children are doing great. So I learned what to do from my community. Even though we had nothing, we made something out of the nothing that we had.
Congratulations, Tanya. It isn't easy.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Let's see if we get Gerald on the line. Gerald's calling us from Kansas City.
Yes, sir. I want to say hello to the author, and
hello.
I like the program.
Thank you.
My question was, what role did Kwanzaa Kanjupu, if any, play in your writing of this book?
And tell us who that is.
He wrote the book Countering the Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys, and there was one previous to that, The Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys.
Hmm.
And he, the book told how boys lose interest in school after the first grade or so in the inner city. And I just wanted to know, had he had any experience from that book at all?
Yes, and the book is actually mentioned in my book.
So, okay.
Interesting you say that. He was just, and this is just my, you know, reading of it. The other side of all of those problems that were going on in the 80s and the 90s is there were plenty of people who were doing what they could, rightly or wrongly, bad and good, but just trying to address the problem and looking for any solution, no matter, you know, what it would be. I mean, sending kids to Kenya to live, you know, completely outside of the community. There were plenty of people. There was an organic group within the African-American community that were doing whatever they could to staunch all of these forces that just seemed to be arrayed. I don't know how much I agree with the notion of conspiracy, although, you know, it may
right.
emotionally felt like that at the time. The point I'm trying to make is for all the bad that was going on, there were so many more people who saw it as their responsibility and their role to address the bad and to, you know, to offer some sort of contribution to the good. I can just offer a comment on the young lady who just called before. One thing I really want to make clear is I don't want to sound like I'm talking down at all to single parents and to people who are in households where usually there is just a mother. I think in so many situations, people who are single parents and in situations where there just is a mother, folks do so much good. My mother was raised in a single parent home, and she raised my mother and her two sisters by herself. And so I think there's so many single parents out there who are also just trying to apply as much pressure as they can to their kids to make sure their kids do the right thing. I wouldn't be here without a single parent.
Gerald, thanks very much for the call. And I just want to ask Ta-Nehisi Coates, your father, for political reasons, didn't celebrate July 4th, which also happened to be his birthday, or Christmas. Does he celebrate Father's Day?
No. No, I called him to offer him a happy Father's Day because my better half told me that I had to about 2 years ago. And, you know, while he was very polite, I talked to him later. He said, man, that felt really, really awkward. My dad, when it came to Father's Day, just believed, man, you go out and you hustle every day. You know what I mean? Every day's Father's Day. Go out and do it. You know, that was his thing.
Ta-Nehisi Coates' book is The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, the East Coast is baking, but the weather in the Midwest, much worse. Tornadoes, flooding, winds, and lightning. If you're affected by the raging storms there, give us a call right now, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.